Hello and welcome to the 12th episode of the Whistleblowers Podcast. I'm Luke DeCox, sports columnist at the Raleigh News and Observer. With me, as always, John Clockerty, who needs no introduction. And John, we had an absolute shocker this week. NC State and UNC played in Raleigh. UNC won. And in the aftermath, I actually got complaints from State fans about the officiating that were actually compliments.
Oh, wow. That is a shocker.
They thought Les Jones, Keith Kimble, and James Breeding did a really good job. So we've made references to State fans on this podcast before. Obviously, there's some who feel the officials are out to get them, and we've discussed that. But I did think it was interesting that in the wake of a very heated rivalry game that State lost, that there were some fans who actually took the time to come out and say, hey, I thought those guys did a good job. And I actually agreed. I thought they did a nice job.
And, you know, I watched the game, and I agree that the crew did a really nice job. Consistent. No game is perfect, but that one, the players played, the officials did their job. And that particular night, the better team won. But for State fans in general to say something positive about the officiating is really refreshing. But those guys did a nice job.
They did, and you and I talked about this at the time. Keith Kimble working that game, that was he had with that game, he's now worked in all Power 5 conferences this year, which is something you usually only see John Higgins do. He didn't this year because he's not working any SEC games for obvious reasons. But Keith Kimble has done all 5. Not the Big East, so if you're a Power 6 guy,
he's
not in there.
Okay.
But he's worked the 5 traditional Power 5 conferences. There may be others. I couldn't find any. There may be others, but he's done the handful, which is kind of impressive.
You know, I know Keith Kimble by having seen him at camp, and when I was a supervisor, he had worked, I think, one of the regionals that I was evaluating, Luke, and I don't know him well, haven't seen him referee a lot, but I know he's highly regarded. So it doesn't surprise me that he did a nice job and being in the ACC for the first time. Maybe he's a comer. Maybe we next thing we see him is the NCAA and watch him advance. But he's highly regarded. He's out of Texas, so he came a long way to referee that game.
Yeah, I think there's a chance, and you would probably know better than I would, that with Brian Dorsey injured, they're scrambling to fill some of those assignments, and that might be one of them.
Yeah, I tell you, that was a big loss. I talked to Brian Kersey about it, and he has a couple more injuries. He has Mike Roberts, who has an Achilles problem, who works a number of games, and John Gaffney also works games. So, he's at this time of the year, you have officials going down, but if you can get a Keith Kimble, Don Daly, AJ DeSay helping you out, you really don't lose much ground.
And one other past episode item I got, it was given, delivered, a clarification on something we discussed earlier, which is the exact actual rule applied in the first State Carolina game where Joel Berry was injured behind the play. Play was stopped. Yeah. He then rejoined the play. So there's a couple things here. One is there's a ruling on this, from the additional rulings section of the book. When an official on his is number 121, when an official on his own initiative stops play to protect an injured player, should a timeout be charged to the team? And the ruling is no. After stopping play, the official should ask the player if the player desires a timeout. When the player does not, play shall be resumed immediately. So that's the timeout thing, unlike, say, the NFL where you can, use a timeout, whatever,
yeah,
if the trainers...
Right.
And the guy, here's the more guidance that I was issued, and this is something that probably the kind of thing you would have sent out when I said something like this back in the day. The guideline is that officials, when recognizing an injured player, allow the immediate play to come to completion, and when there is a pause in action, to stop play and attend to the health and safety of the injured player. And so we, you and I were debating, does, UNC still have the ball there, or NC State still have the ball there, does that count? And the clarification is on the NC State play, after the pack attacked the basket and then passed the ball back out to the perimeter, stopping play at that point was appropriate. So the idea was NC State was allowed to complete the ensuing play, but when they reset their offense at that point, the official Jamie Lucky blew his whistle, and that was considered appropriate.
So, from what you just said, that Jamie Lucky feeling as though the player was injured, once they weren't attacking the basket, he stopped play. And I think obviously he's within his right, and the rules cover him on that. The thing that looked bad is once they're up court and in a set, he looks back and he thinks he's hurt, and then when he blows his whistle, he gets up and comes
yeah,
up.
And I think as we said last time, that's just kind of bad luck.
Yeah, that and then he looked bad. Then the whole thing looks bad because it looks like, in essence, he's given Carolina a chance to equal the number of players and takes the advantage away from State.
All right. Thus concludes the errors and errata portion of our.
Well, it's good program. That a writer like yourself can go back and do a retake.
Are we doing writer's accountability again? Let me direct you to episode 12 for that whole discussion. Episode 11 for that whole discussion. The re-recorded and sadly not as good as the lost episode 11. So something that happened, actually, we're recording on Thursday, something that happened on Wednesday, Valentine's Day, in the State-Syracuse game. Markell Johnson had a breakaway layup. He kind of lands entangled with Frank Howard, who shoves him down. Markell Johnson gets up, gets in Frank Howard's face. Howard shoves him again, and they both get technicals, where State, you know, felt that Howard was the aggressor. And that did seem to be one of those situations where Howard did more, but Johnson, by getting in Howard's face, had kind of made it impossible for it not to be a double technical. But that reminded you of something that happened in your officiating career.
Yeah, before we start recording, I had a similar situation in my first year. Florida State's playing at Duke, and Florida State has a nice team, and they're playing really well. And at this point in time, they're playing even or even ahead. And we get into the second half, and Sheldon Williams and another player from Florida State. And I'm going to say his name was Johnson also, but I could be mistaken. But I'm almost 75% sure his name was Johnson. But anyway, there's an action similar to yours where there's a layup and there's a pretty hard foul. And we called the foul on the kid from Florida State. The foul was clear, but Sheldon Williams goes to the floor. He gets up, and he pushes the kid from Florida State, pushes him backward, both hands in the chest, knocks him backwards. And Johnson from Florida State backs up, raises his hand like, I'm not getting involved in this, and just takes a step or two back, and a very good official, but now again, this was 13 years ago, he tees up, Mike Eads tees up both players, Florida State player, Duke player. Comes to find out that the technical assessed to Florida State player is his fifth. And he has.
And this is Alexander Johnson, the Florida State
thank
center.
You, thank okay. you. That's exactly who it was. And he has to go to the bench, and because it's his fifth foul, and he's having a career night. He was the best player. Could have been the best player on the floor that night. He is really having a great night. He goes out on the play. In hindsight, I suspend the whole crew. Should not have, in hindsight, maybe taken action against Mike Eads, but Florida State thought that there should have been a penalty. They were forcing the action at the time that something needs to be done, and I suspended all three. And looking back, that was probably not the best thing for me to do. And quite honestly, I've talked to my commissioner, Swofford, after that, and he says, "Yeah," he says, "that John, you're right." He says, "Probably wasn't well served." He says, "Maybe just the guy that gave the technicals," but. I think sometimes officials get excited, and because there's two players involved, they think they're doing the right thing, Luke, and when in fact maybe there was just one. I mean, they called a foul against Johnson. So, they you know, they penalized him. That was his fourth foul. Then the technical sent him out, which we shouldn't have done.
Yeah, it's hard sometimes because, you know, it's the old rule about the – it's never the punch that gets you. It's the guy who responds to the punch because you missed the first one.
Right.
And there was a little of that last night, I think, with Markell Johnson and Frank Howard where, you know, the it's the confrontation that gets everyone's attention, not the fact that Howard had pushed him down initially. But that and the one similarity there is that was Markell Johnson's fourth foul in that game, late in that game, and then he came back obviously to help.
Made
State.
A pretty big shot at the end, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yes, he sure did. So that ended up not actually hurting State, but it was an interesting situation where clearly there's something going on there that's technical worthy, and it's, you know, given the circumstance, very difficult to determine whether it's one guy gets it or you know the double as it happened.
I mean, it doesn't necessarily if one of the players gets pushed back because he was taunting or saying something in a guy's face, he may not have physically done anything other than, you know, be part of that
sort of
problem.
Escalate the confrontation.
Yeah, you know, he may have caused that guy to push him back. But I don't know if that happened, but sometimes it doesn't necessarily mean there's physical contact.
Yeah, it was just sort of I'm not sure we would mention it if it hadn't just happened last night, but mm-hmm. It was kind of an interesting one where you're sort of damned if you do, damned if
you
don't. Especially, you know, in the Carrier Dome, if the Syracuse guy gets teed up there in a close game and the State guy doesn't, they're going to burn that place down, potentially. Not that they weren't anyway after the way that game ended with State just absolutely shooting the lights out in the second half.
Yeah.
That was a memorable moment for you as a supervisor. We've alluded a number of times on this show to games that you've actually officiated, memorable games, and some of the players and coaches that you've dealt with. But we haven't really kind of gone through your career in toto. I'm curious, when you look back at how many years were you an elite power conference official?
Oh, probably my first ACC was in 75, 76. So we're refereeing Big East, SEC, ACC, even some Big 12 games. I did four of those conferences. I didn't go past, and there was an old conference called the Metro Conference.
Sure.
It turned into the American now. But, I refereed all over the country, but if Keith Kimble refereed all five of those power conferences, he's traveling a lot, and you know, a guy like John Higgins also is traveling, but our guys do also. I mean, Roger Ayers works Big East, SEC, ACC. I don't think he works in the Big Ten, but that's what officials do now.
Sure,
you know, they formed this an alliance with the Big East, Atlantic 10, and the ACC. And one of their objectives, one of their plan was, if we can get officials to concentrate on these three leagues, and maybe they don't have to travel.
They're not flying to Omaha. Well, I guess they might be for a Creighton game, but
they're
not flying to Dallas on a Tuesday
night
and coming back, or
Arkansas.
Yeah,
you know, which I had to do, go to Arkansas and LSU. But
now I remember seeing you when I was traveling for hockey and you were traveling for officiating, and Chip and I would be in the airport and he'd see you and call you over. I mean, I didn't know you then. No,
yeah,
I know.
You weren't
paying any attention to hockey. I probably met you about five times during the 2002 playoffs when you were on your way to various places.
But I think the Alliance trying to get officials some rest and less travel and. I think it's a good idea, and maybe some other leagues will join the alliance and make it even easier for the officials.
So for you, when you look, all right, so your career, you're doing this for 30 years. What games stand out for you when you tell stories, you speak at a banquet, or you give a motivational speech?
Yeah, I don't want to make this sound egotistical because I try not to, but I refereed 12 Final Fours in a 16-year period from 85 to 2000, and the years 90, 94, 95, and I think 99 I didn't referee, but from 85 to 2000, I was involved in the Final Four 12 times. And time's not going to allow us to go over all the games, but there was certain ones that will always stand out. All Final Four stand out, but there are certain ones that I think that as far as my memory will always be there and the ones that I talk to when I speak to a group. And my first Final Four was in 85, Luke. It was Villanova Georgetown. And it's one of the great upsets. Georgetown was clearly, by everybody's opinion,
sure,
the best team in the country. They had Patrick Ewing, and they had a kid named Williams who can shoot the lights out of it. And they had complimentary players, and they were a great defensive team. And
you'd seen both of those teams multiple times during the year,
I had. And Villanova was an eighth seed, maybe a ninth seed. Eight or nine. I guess they felt like, you know, they were fortunate to be in the tournament. And the next thing you know, they're playing well and make a long story. They end up in the Final Four against Georgetown, and they play maybe the cleanest, best played game strategic wise than maybe any Final Four. They only missed one shot in the second half.
Yep.
So they shoot a high percentage against a very good defensive team, and they upset them. And I had an opportunity to visit with Rolly Massimino. He came to Raleigh that summer, and I introduced him to a sports group who was paying him to come down here. I picked him up at the airport, Rolly Massimino, the coach of Villanova, and I brought him down here. So, I really felt like I refereed the game. He coached it. I was free to ask him some questions. And one of the things I asked him, I said, Rolly, how did you pull it off? And he said to me, and it made sense, he said, John, we had played Georgetown either two or three times prior to that game. We played them during the regular season, and I think he might have played them in the Big East tournament. He says, we knew how they played. We knew everything about Georgetown. He says, and what I told our players, now Rolly's telling me this.
Yeah.
He says, what I told our players is, we don't have to play a lot better. We just have to play a little bit better. We got to shoot the ball a little bit better. We got to protect the ball a little bit better. We got to rebound a little bit better. We don't have to be spectacular. We just got to be a little bit better because we've played these teams and we know we can compete against them. Now, he's talking to his team, and his team believes it because Pickney knows he can play against Ewing.
Yeah.
Okay? And their guards can play against them. And not only did they play just a little bit better, they played a great better. And it ended up an incredible first, and you know, everybody says, just like you talk about Keith Kimball and that crew that worked that game, everybody thought we did a spectacular job, and I'll take those accolades, except there wasn't a whole lot to referee. The ball was going in, there wasn't a lot of fouling. We had two coaches that are very volatile, but because they like each other. John Thompson wasn't looking down at Rolly, and Rolly wasn't looking down at John. There's a thing about that. If they're okay with each other, you don't have to referee the benches.
Yeah.
One caveat to that, everybody talked about how Villanova slowed the ball down and played deliberate. They did. But Billy Rafferty told me at one point, years later, they put a 35-second shot clock on that game, and Villanova would never have had a shot clock violation. Everybody said, oh, they were so deliberate and this and that. If they had put a clock on it, they would never have done that.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. It does bring up a point that something I learned from doing this podcast with you that I assume most officials already know, but that the more shots the teams make, the easier the game is to officiate.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that you get, like, the national title game last year where Gonzaga and North Carolina come out for the second half and neither team can make a shot. That's when everyone starts talking about the officials.
Yeah, that's because, like, when you make all your shots, they missed one shot, okay, the second half. When you make all your shots, one of the toughest areas to referee is rebounding. Everybody's crashing the boards, and you've got a lot of decisions. But when the ball goes in, you play on. You
just run down the other end.
Right, that's right. You know, so when you're shooting all that high percentage, and so, you know, again, I'd like to say we did a great job, but the teams did the great job. We just kept in the flow and tried not to interrupt a great game. Luke, the other one, I refereed 85, 86, 87, and 88. I bring this one out because Kansas is playing Oklahoma in the championship game.
This is in Kansas City, too,
in
right?
Kansas City, 50th year in Kansas City. And Oklahoma has Wayman Tisdale, a kid named King, and they're really good, and probably a number one seed.
And oh, Nova was an 8 seed, by the way, just to backtrack.
Nova was an 8 seed?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I got that wrong.
And something interesting is Kansas has one great player, and he's really good.
He turned out okay.
he did okay. So Larry Brown put his team on Danny Manning's shoulders, and Danny Manning killed them to win the national championship. Everybody thought that you cannot run with Oklahoma. They just got too much speed, too many good players. You can't run with them. And I was the referee in the game, and going in, I told Timmy Higgins and Eddie Hightower, we may have a little bit of a deliberate game here. Little did I know, that tells you what I know, Larry Brown said, no, there's no way. He said, we're going to play these guys. And the score at halftime is 50-50. They said, no, we're not slowing this game down. I've got the best player there is, and we're going to. So I bring that one out because I see Danny from time to time, obviously as his supervisor, and I tell him what a great job he did and that I really enjoyed the game. And he always brings up 1986 when he was a young kid and we got him in foul trouble against Duke when Duke beat Kansas. And I said, Danny, you don't have to bring that up. Okay, just let's talk about 1988.
We talked about that on this podcast last year, not the 88 game, the 86 game, and you getting him in foul trouble. I remember I ran into him in the hallway last spring at Larry Joel, and I actually said something to him about it. And he even glared at me. I mean, he laughed about it.
Yeah.
But you could tell there was something back, still in the back of his head.
We did a terrible job. You hate to do, I mean, no. I mean, like, I refereed with two officials that I had never been on the floor with, which is the NCAA, never make that mistake again. One was from San Antonio, the other was from Denver, and here I'm refereeing with them, and we're just trying to push that stone up the hill all night long, and I get Danny in foul trouble, we do, and Larry Brown's a mess, and it just wasn't a good night, and you hate to have that, but I can admit when you know, you have good nights and bad nights, and that was not one that we did very good. But, you know, in 89...
Hold on, let's bet, before we move on, 88, Danny and the Miracles, that was the Stacey King and Mookie Blaylock for Oklahoma.
Yeah. And Raymond Tisdale, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
How about that lineup?
Let's check that. Let's double check that one real quick.
How about that? That's a pretty good lineup.
No, that is, you know, that's a national title team in any other year. See if Manning was still there.
I think so. Luke, you're pretty good.
Wayman Tisdale was gone by then. He graduated in 85.
Oh, okay.
The late Wayman Tisdale. So, Mookie Blaylock is famous for his name, among other things.
Yeah.
All right, 89, we've obviously discussed. I think our very first podcast, we dug into 89.
And we'll go back over real quick. But, you know, in 89, I was on a roll. It was my fifth year in a row. I was on top of my game, feeling really good. And I get assigned the championship game between Seton Hall and Michigan. We talked about, you know, this earlier, Luke, so I won't rehash it, but...
No, rehash it.
It was the first overtime in 26 years of Final Four. They end regulation tied, and we we're refereeing are really good.
There's Who did you work with on that game?
I worked with Mickey Crawley and Tommy Rucker. Tommy Rucker's from Detroit. Mickey Crawley was a Northeast New York guy. We were comfortable. We're seeing the same game. Everything's cool. Seton Hall is playing good, and Michigan's, and we come down to the last possession, and Ramil Robinson, who was Michigan's best player, pushes the ball up the floor. Either it was Green or Moulton gets contact in the lane. Minimal contact. Now that it's 30 years later, you know, and I blow a whistle. My instincts take over. I blow the whistle, and there's 4 seconds or 3.8 seconds or something in 4 seconds, and I put Ramil Robinson at the line. And Ramil Robinson's a 68% free throw shooter. First of all, I'm not, you know, I know what I just done. You're not a fool. You just are going to decide the national championship game at the free throw line. But Ramil Robinson's a 68% free throw shooter. I have to administer the free throw. He was cold-blooded. He didn't blink, and he makes both of them, and the game ends because Seton Hall can't get anything good. And we go in the locker room, and Tommy Rucker's from Detroit. And remember, Michigan's in this game. And Tommy Rucker turned to me and just said, "John, I don't know about the foul, but thank God it was you and not me calling this foul living in Detroit." You know, I can remember that. And then Henry Nichols came in and he said, "There's going to be a brouhaha about this." Well, the media made it what it is, okay, a controversial Final Four. But I had a coach in P.J. Carlissimo who I had refereed multiple times, and he trusted me. And because he trusted me, he took the high road. And when he was questioned about the foul, and again, I'm trying to be verbatim, he says, "John Clockerty, if he said it was a foul, we're going to live with that." He says, "I would not want anybody in that position to make that call any better than John Clockerty." Well, now what he's done is just saved my butt. Okay, because if he says something different, it gets more publicity, it gets more negative publicity, and so forth. But PJ said that, and I've seen PJ a number of times since then, and he's always been very gracious, and he lives with it. He told me, he says, "I don't think it's a foul." This is personally afterwards. He says, "Is there contact?" "Yes." He says, "But," he said, "you're good enough to let that contact go and see what happens." He's 100% right, Luke. But sometimes your instinct says there's a foul, and you do that. But that was probably the only huge controversial in 12 Final Fours. And I've had to live with it. Every time Dick Vitale, who's a Seton Hall graduate, would see me at one of the games, "John Clockerty, 1989 Final Four referee." And I'm thinking, "Dick, the story's old. Just give it a break, you know?" But that's Vitale. He's always going to do something like that. But that was, and I've seen Steve Fisher multiple times. He said, "I thought it was okay." He was a Michigan coach. He said, "No, I think it was okay." So, but I had enough in the bank to survive that. If it was my first Final Four and the only Final Four, I probably would not had continued to work those championship games.
Is that why you didn't work the Final Four in 90?
Yes, there's no question. I could have been close to perfect. They were going to give me some reprieve. they were going to say, you know, this guy needs a break. Because, Luke, I came back and worked 91, 92, and 93. So they just said, you know, let's give this guy a year off. And deservedly so. But 91 was probably, when we talk about 85 as being a major upset, it was. But I'm telling you, in 91, Luke, it's the most memorable Final Four that I had of all 12. In 1991, Duke is going to play UNLV. And UNLV had beaten Duke in 1990 by 30 points. And nobody can compete with UNLV that year. Zero. They had won every one of their games undefeated. None of the games were competitive. It was 25 or 23 point average loss to the other teams. They had beaten Duke by 30 the year before. And I tell our crew, because I was the referee in the game, and I tell our crew, if this gets out of hand, let's hang in there, because this game was ugly. And I don't know what's going to happen, but with Larry Johnson and the guards they had and the people they had coming back, there's not much difference in this team than the team that beat Duke by 30. And we go out, and I have a Tommy O'Neill and Teddy Valentine. Okay, two really good referees. And we work a really, really good game. But what I remember of that game was the difference in 90 and 91 was Grant Hill. Grant Hill was such a special player, but Stacy Augman, maybe the best defender in the country for UNLV, and maybe the primo defender in the NBA. He won multiple NBA Defensive Player of the Year. And he faced up against Grant Hill, and Grant Hill just took right off by him and dunked the ball. And I said, wow, you know, this may be a little bit different than and Coach Krzyzewski has said Grant Hill was the difference, but Bobby Hurley was a year older and much more aggressive. And Christian Leitner may have been the best clutch player in the country. He made all the big shots. So they competed, and they took UNLV right down to the last basket. UNLV had the last shot, and Larry Johnson has an open look and passes it off to a kid out on the perimeter, and he has to rush the shot, and he makes a bad shot, and Duke wins and then goes on and wins the national championship. That was a semifinal game and goes on to win a national championship in 91. But they were the two best teams in 91. They were the two best teams. And maybe UNLV was the best team, but they weren't the best team that night.
Right.
You know, and I recovered from my faux pas in 89 to referee 91, 92, and 93. And the only other game that I'll make note of, my last Final Four was 2000.
Did you know at the time it was your last Final Four?
No, but I refereed till 05, and I refereed regional finals, but
sure.
But I did not know. And I have Wisconsin and Michigan. And
so we have you to blame for that game.
You know, the the game was like going to the dentist. It was so, first of all, Coach Izzo and Coach Bennett knew each other and knew how to play and what they were going to do. And I think we had about 5,000 illegal screens, and we didn't call any of them. And the coaches didn't care, because I'm telling you, I did not hear a word from Coach Izzo or Coach Bennett on any of the plays. We get in at halftime, and the halftime score is 19-17. And Higgins looks at me, and he just, oh, man, this is awful. I says, I think we're okay. He said, okay. He says, I don't think they're going to score 40 points. I said, well, you know, we'll see. But the game ended 53-41 favor Michigan State. I shouldn't have said Michigan. Michigan State, and Michigan State wins the national championship. One of the things that's ironic about that, Tony Bennett goes to Virginia, and Brian Gregory goes to
Georgia Tech.
They both were on the bench for that Final Four. And I'm having our spring meetings, and I'm having lunch with both of them because they're good friends. And I bring it up, they said they thought the game was great. I said, that game was awful for Final Four. He said, no, it was okay. But it's funny, but Tony and Brian Gregory and I had reminisced about the game, and that was kind of fun to do.
The one you didn't mention among all those years that stands out for me, I mean, there's a bunch in there that stand out, but the 87 Indiana-Syracuse game, that was for me as a kid at the time. I think I was 12. That was the first NCAA tournament I remember watching every game of, you know, that was available on CBS. I remember watching Louisville-Duke.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first year I was really into it. And I remember that Indiana and Keith Smart and Syracuse and Ronnie Cicely.
I didn't have that game.
Oh.
That was the championship game.
Which game? You
I had Indiana's UNLV.
Oh, okay.
Bob Knight beat Tark's team. That was a semifinal.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then Syracuse and Billy Donovan and Patino and Providence and the other.
That's exactly right.
I remember that Final Four like it was yesterday.
You know, every one of these have a story to them. But when I had Utah against Carolina in a semifinals, Utah went on to win the championship. Majerus was our coach,
mm-hmm.
and we had a situation. Were you with the News and Observer at the time in 98?
I was not. I was covering college hockey in 1998.
Okay. Maktar Jai spit on a kid from Utah, and we never picked it up. The crew never picked up on it.
Does that? I mean, now, not to distract you from the story, but how often does something like that happen where you just have, it happens behind the play, you're looking the other way, all three of you guys.
It doesn't happen now because they'll go to the monitor.
All right. Yeah.
Okay. Like if a guy hit a kid in his privates, and you're not going to see all of those. But today, if a kid went, oh my God, I got hit. First thing our guy's going to do is go to the monitor.
Sure.
Okay. And if Maktar Jai spit in the kid from Utah, and we didn't get it, and it was brought up afterwards, and I was asked, did I see any of this, and did I know that the kid from Utah made a racial remark to Maktar Jai? I said, no, man, I don't know anything about that.
Was this by an NCAA person or by a pool
reporter?
Yeah,
by an NCAA person.
Okay.
By an NCAA person, because Maktar said he spit on him because the kid made a racial remark. Well, Majerus took exception to it. Really, that's the biggest fat lie. I remember he says, and here's what I'm going to do. We're flying to Carolina, and we're going to get a polygraph on both these guys because my guy never said that, and neither would he ever say that. And then Maktar Jai backed up on it.
Hmm.
So that, you know, that, like I say, Kentucky-Syracuse was interesting because we have Syracuse, Jim Boeheim, and the first guy he hired, one of the first guys was Rick Pitino, early in his career. Now Rick's on top of his game, and he's playing the guy that gave him a big chance. So when I go and speak, the next thing is would be questions, and it'd be 100 questions about these games.
It's funny, but when I was a kid, when Majerus was at Utah, and obviously he was there for a while, I was in high school maybe, I can't remember, maybe eighth grade, we went on a family trip out west, and we stayed at that hotel, I can't remember what
it
was called.
Did he stay at?
Yeah, and we were in the elevator with him like three times, and my dad kept saying, you know, he's hard to miss, or he was hard to miss. Yeah, kept saying, that's Rick Majerus. I was kind of like, eh. And then years later, I was like, oh man, I was in an elevator like three times with Rick Majerus, and he was, you know, in his sweatpants going down to walk on the treadmill at 2 miles an hour.
He's another guy could be pretty volatile, but the games I had him, he was good. But you know, he was really kind of a loner, and he lived mm-hmm. never married, lived in this hotel, and I guess it wasn't strange for people that knew him, but. His first, the guy that gave him his chance was McGuire, the coach of Marquette, Al McGuire.
Al McGuire.
Al McGuire got Majerus started in basketball, but
I remember, I think it was 2012 in Columbus, I was there with NC State in the first weekend of the NCAA tournament, and St. Louis played Memphis. Majerus was coaching St. Louis.
Yeah, that's
right. Memphis had a much better team. It was coached by Josh Pastner.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And Majerus in that game, that first-round game, might have been a second-round game. I think it was a first-round game. Absolutely coached figure eights around Majerus. Yeah, whatever Pastner had, Majerus was two steps ahead of him. He had the personnel in the game before Pastner changed his defense. It was like watching one of those chess grandmasters play 7 8-year-olds at the same time.
Sure.
And just move from board to board, knocking the clocks off and taking pieces. He was something else.
Look, the North Carolina Utah game, Bill Guthrie, 98, I think Bill Guthrie. I think Dean was probably, Coach Smith was probably retired, and Utah beat. I would bet Carolina had better personnel, and I'm just saying that because Majerus could really coach.
Yeah.
I mean, really coach.
Well, that was a good Utah team, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that was clearly, yeah. I mean, that was a good Utah team. Well, that was a good trip down memory lane. Are there any non-tournament games that stick with you? Some of those games back in the Big East where each player got nine personal fouls before they fouled
them? One of the ones that... this was early in my career, but I do remember because I was assigned Ralph Sampson's last game at Virginia, and they always played Maryland in their last game. And we got Ralph in foul trouble. John Moreau, myself, and Hank Nichols, and we got Ralph in foul trouble in the first half, and he had to sit more minutes, and Maryland was really good. Lefty had a nice team, as he always did. And one of the things we get in there, and Hank Nichols being Hank Nichols, who was my mentor and also taught me how to officiate through tough love, he just says, here's the deal. There's got to be blood on the floor before we foul Ralph out. He said, there are no soft fouls. He says, he's got like two or three. He says, if he fouls out, we are going to know that it was a hard foul. So I says, okay, I get it. You mean, I get the message, what we're doing here. And we went out, and Ralph, we put Ralph at the free throw line to decide the game, and he was shaking. Literally, I mean, they had tuxedos and everything. I mean, it was a big night for Ralph. Ralph stayed around 4 years.
Yeah.
And he was shaking. He missed a free throw so bad, and it came off. He grabbed it and put it back in and everybody celebrated. And I mean, there was games like that that I had that were, I mean, I had Arkansas, Kentucky, when Arkansas, Nolan Richardson had good teams, and they were rock fights. I mean, they were just hard games, but then one of the players that I refereed, Luke, that nobody could match up, nobody in the country, was Shaquille O'Neal. He was a man among boys. Arizona went into his place, into LSU, with the best back line in the country, and Shaquille destroyed them, just destroyed. You remember Brian Williams, the kid that passed away? They had him plus two other ones on the back line. Shaquille destroyed them.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a different player than everybody. Bigger, stronger, timing. And, of course, we know what he did in the NBA. He had multiple championships. But those kind of games will live forever.
Yeah. Shaq was actually in the Bahamas for no apparent reason when I was down there covering basketball at Thanksgiving. He just showed up for the State Arizona game and sat with, like, the interior minister of the Bahamas. Watch the game, and it was just a steady stream. Like, people stopped watching the game. They just wanted to watch Shaq. Still, now.
And such a personality. You know, like, I don't think Shaq could ever be mean to anybody. I mean, some guys are just, I don't know, but Shaq just seems to be a fun-loving guy and a guy that would I want to take a selfie with you. Sure, you know.
Was he easy to officiate?
Yeah, no, you're a monster. But he'd never complain.
That's what I mean, yeah.
No. When we had the Arizona game, he just about fouled every one of them out because they couldn't manage him. And then I can remember Lute Olson said, no more dunks. Whatever, there's just no more dunks.
Yeah.
He caught the ball, and they grabbed his arms, and then he's taking them up with him. Okay? I mean, he's pulling off.
An intentional foul, one?
So I call a foul. I waited for, held the whistle, and I called the foul, and I remember Shaq looking at me saying, you weren't really going to call that, were you? I mean, like, he's just, he was, and I laughed, and he laughed, but that was the deal. Lute Olson says, no more foul, no more dunking. They threw it to him, and he was just going to slam it home. He played with a kid that was really good, a kid named Chris Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Mustafa.
Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf.
Woo. Could he play? If he says, I'm putting 40 on you tonight,
yeah.
You were getting 40.
Those were powerful teams at LSU there, Dale Brown, and mm-hmm. that was something.
Stanley Roberts,
another one.
Yeah.
One of the things that you and I talked about in talking about what we wanted to talk about today, the things we talk about, some of the new faces in the ACC this year, some of the guys that you've noticed. I mean, obviously, you know all these guys, whether they worked for you or not. But some of those guys, who have you noticed, or who have you seen that you've liked on some of these, or have noticed on some of these ACC games this year?
You know, I want to. We see new faces, and I think that's good, Luke. My hat's off to Brian Kersey. I didn't do that as much as he's done it. I brought some guys in, and I trained some guys, some guys that I had for a long time, that eventually the Dorseys, the Ayers, the Eads, the Luckies that went to the Final Four. I can't take credit for it, but I didn't, you know, I lived with those guys, and I gave them a lot of games, and maybe I didn't build the staff with new guys that I should have. It was just the way I was managing my roster, but I noticed that Brian... And this is good. It cuts down on the exposure from some of the frontline guys. But, you know, I wrote some names. We talked about Keith Kimble. If he can get Keith Kimble in here and work some games. I saw Don Daly last night. Don Daly is a Midwestern guy, but Don Daly is going to be a Final Four referee. He's very good. I've known him. He never applied to the ACC. Kersey had gone out, in my opinion, and talked these guys and maybe helping them out with some games.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Lee Cassell is a primary now. Mark Schnur never got games for me. He's working games. James Breeding is working more games. Here's a young guy that did not do well when I saw him. But the games I saw AJ DeSay work, it's working pretty good. Working pretty good. And I think Brian's putting him with veteran guys where all he has to do is referee his area. Doesn't have to be.
Now let me stop you right there because I'm curious about this. When you form an opinion about a guy who maybe you give a couple games to and don't like, and maybe he's not ready for it or whatever,
mm-hmm.
does it almost take a change in supervisors to get another look at that point?
Yeah. AJ, I had him at LeBron James Skills Academy for 2 years because Joe Forte and Nolan Fine says the guy's got a lot of promise. Every time he came to camp, I think he was so nervous that he felt like this was his shot. He had to impress me. He had to do it now. And I had guys that I thought at camp that were in front of him. But maybe, and I'm not an intimidating guy, but he knows that I'm looking at him. I'm going to give him a chance, but I need to see him work. And he didn't work well. He's working better in the ACC games than he did in camp games. I've watched him, and he's refereeing really well, and I'm proud of him. But maybe it was... how he regarded me, but, you know, Kersey's more his age. Well, not more his age, but, you know, Kersey was just right out of, and he didn't, he's doing well. And I, I don't know this. I don't know the officials in the ACC tournament. I don't know them. I'm not even sure the invitations have been put out. But I wouldn't be surprised if A.J. Desai gets a game in the ACC tournament.
All right, when you've got and I think we'll probably save this for next week, because I think we can do a big ACC tourney edition of this podcast. I think we did last year, and maybe we'll know some of those assignments by then. When you have a 15-game tournament, now when it was an 8-game tournament, you knew exactly how many guys you needed. You needed, whatever it is, 12 mm-hmm. enough guys to work Thursday, or Friday at the time. 15-team tournament, how many guys do you need?
Ooh,
15-game tournament.
Yeah, that's a good question.
14-game tournament.
I don't have the numbers, Luke. We can talk about that. I have my records that I would go back and look at it. But you're going to probably have guys that are going to work. We never worked. Nobody ever worked 4 games. What is a tournament? 5 days now?
Yeah. Yeah, 5 days.
Yeah. Nobody ever worked 4 games that I'm aware of. So we brought enough guys and worked 1 day, 2 games. Then other guys worked 3 games. But anybody that worked the finals didn't work the semifinals.
Right.
So they would work 2 games plus the semifinals. And I would have to work on the numbers, but I can't remember exactly. But I don't know how Brian Kersey is working that now. But I think last year, I don't think anybody that worked the semifinals worked the finals. I don't know that for sure. Maybe you.
No. That's still the tradition. Unlike some other conferences, you get 9 guys who work the weekend, kind of like the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, there's a guy Matt Potter. Boy, Matt Potter's pretty good. I had him in the Atlantic 10, and he gave the Big East primary. I should have gotten him because I see him working ACC games. The first time I spotted him, he worked a Big South tournament championship game, and I thought he was really good, and brought him to camp, and I said, I'm going to hire you for the ACC. He says, Mr. Clockerty, he says, I got a call earlier in the day that the Big East offered me a contract, and I accepted it. I was happy for him, but mad that I didn't that I didn't get him first. So, but there's new faces, and I want to say that I think it's good. I think seeing Lee Cassell and Joe Lindsay with more games and Brent Hampton's got some games. They're fresh faces, and I don't know how the coaches feel, but it doesn't matter as long as they referee the games well. What does it matter? What the good, as long as they're doing the job.
Yeah.
I
think that's a pretty good place to stop. We're gonna come back for episode 13 and talk about the tournament. And I think we'll dig into those numbers. You can get out your files.
Yeah, I can get out.
Talk about the process of inviting guys to the tournament, mm-hmm. How you make those decisions, and then scheduling the tournament, because that's something you can't do until you know what the teams are. So I think that's a good place to stop. Also, I promise all of our listeners, this is my solemn promise to you, next episode, we will talk about the KH stickers.
Oh, well...
don't spoil it.
No, I'm not. I won't even go there. We'll talk about that and a few other things that caused me some heartburn.
John, in our next episode, John unburdens himself. So don't miss that. It's going to be our officiating supervisor therapy session. Next time on our banner ACC tournament edition. So thank you for listening. As always, if you have questions, if you have comments, if you have complaints, at Luke Decock on Twitter, ldecock@newsobserver.com on the email. If anyone's listening to this and they want this to be on Google Play, I haven't had any specific requests for that, but I'm happy to go ahead and do that if there's any demand for it there. It seems like most people are content with iTunes or the SoundCloud deal, but that's something I'm happy to do. So John, go get your files, and we'll dig through those next time.
Perfect.
Thank you very much for listening, everyone.